The connection between poetry and transcendence.
Whether I'm conscious of it or not, I'm always seeking some kind, some form of transcendence. Probably in every poem I write. And that's hard to find. I mean, maybe it's why I write hundreds and hundreds of drafts, because I'm asking an awful lot of the idea. And once I can approach that, once I can find that, I feel transported emotionally, which is what I want.
That's poet Philip Schultz, and this is Writer's Voice. Compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, listeners, it's that time of year again, Poetry Month. To celebrate, we talk with a poet of great experience, reflection, and hard-won grace. Philip Schultz is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Failure and one of America's most distinctive contemporary poets. His work has long explored the inner life, its doubts, its contradictions and longings, with a rare mix of emotional honesty, philosophical depth, and often surprising humor. Now in his latest collection, Enormous Mourning, Schultz writes from a new vantage point, his 80th year. These poems take on aging, memory, family, and mortality, but also something else, renewal, the possibility of gaining a new, more joyous perspective on life at a late age. The book opens with a walk through a cemetery. Yet what emerges is not just a meditation on death, but a vivid sense of continuity. The past and present coexist. The living and the dead are in conversation. And throughout the collection, Schultz moves from the particulars of daily life, a movie, a memory, a friendship, into larger questions about meaning, suffering, and what it is to live ethically in a troubled world. We talk about how age changes perception, how poetry can transform regret into something like forgiveness, and how creativity itself can be a source of resilience and joy. We also talk about the political dimension of the book, poems that grapple with democracy, moral courage, and the unsettling forces shaping our current moment. For Schultz, poetry is not an escape from reality. It's a way of entering into it more deeply, asking harder questions. As he puts it, writing a poem can be a way of confronting even the most difficult truths and finding, if not answers, then a kind of clarity or even transcendence. Philip Schultz is the founder and director of the Writer's Studio in New York. He's the author of numerous poetry collections, including Failure, as well as The God of Loneliness. His work often explores personal history, family, and Jewish and immigrant experience, including his father's struggles, which he addressed with striking honesty in his book Failure. He lives in East Hampton, New York, with his wife, sculptor Monica Banks. Schultz joins us to read from Enormous Mourning and to talk about a life in poetry, what it means to look back, take stock, and keep searching for meaning. I spoke with him in his writer's studio in East Hampton. Let's listen now. Philip Schultz, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here.
You're one of my favorite poets, and I think that this is one of my favorite books of yours. I don't know if it's because I'm in a similar place of life as you, or I think that there is a spiritual dimension to these poems that is even more, is the word lambent, evocative, than what I remember, although I think that that's a theme in all of your books. Enormous Mourning opens with you walking through a cemetery, this morning of my 80th year, as you say. How has writing from this stage of life changed what you notice or what feels urgent to say?
Well, I have a perspective now that I always didn't have. And I find that in looking back, I'm also, in a sense, looking ahead or trying to find perspective. And in terms of the world we now live in, trying to understand, trying to find meaning. But age has, you know, given me in a kind of love of my life and the lives of others that I always didn't have or own. I didn't possess it in the way I do now. And it comes through perspective, I think.
Yes, and I think you really put your finger on what I was struggling to express. There is that lightness and a sense of joy. And also there's a sense of, throughout the book, of living simultaneously with the past and the present, almost as if the dead are still in conversation with you. How do you understand that relationship?
Yes, sometimes, as far as Monica, my wife, thinks too frequently. Yes, this kind of perspective brings things back with an understanding that I never possessed before. Mm-hmm. And it makes me all the more fond of, I just feel lucky in a way I never felt before. I feel that the people in my life, my wife, my kids, the school, the teachers, the students I work with, how did all this happen to me? I'm such a screw-up. I mean, how is it possible that I made such a meaningful life when, you know, we'll read a poem, my mistakes. I mean, they're with me forever. And yet somehow I did some things right. And I think that is the motivating factor in this book and in these poems. I also appreciate the sacrifice of others in a way that I never could before.
Say more about that.
Well, I mean, there's a poem. My mother plays a very large role in this book, and it has a presence that she never did in my other poems. I was too busy dealing with my father and other men and struggling for balance or position and whatever. And somehow I began to understand the role she played in my life, the role women play in my life. So many of my teachers and students in our school, the writer's studio, are women. So many people that I have loved. And then I realize also the sacrifice that they made to foster others, to help, and certainly in my case, and the long poem at the end of the book, in many ways, is about that.
Say the title.
Something and Nothing.
That's right, Something and Nothing. And we may get to that, and certainly we'll talk more about some of the women you write about in the book. And Your Mistake, you have that poem, My Mistakes, in the book, and you wrote another very successful poetry volume called Failure. But I still want to start out with the title poem, Enormous Morning. So I wonder if you would read that for us.
Enormous Morning. It's an early winter morning, the morning of my 80th year, and I'm walking my Great Pyrenees mix binks through the Cedar Lawn Cemetery, visiting the Grimshaws, Talmadges, and Kings, whose opinions are echoing off their mildewed limestone and slate names. Benny Janes in 1706, still wondering if a second windmill on Old Hook Hill will improve the value of his estate. Young William Lamb arguing with old Henry Hattell about the odds for and against going to World War I or debtor's prison. Lucy Rudershahn advising Sally Ann Bennett against wearing a hand-sewn wedding dress. It's not fine or lacy enough. And a Jeffrey Arnold Cobb IV wondering where on Shelter Island to properly bury slaves, while yellow-breasted wobblers caw at us about graves we've left untended, blessings squandered. And yes, here I am, older than I ever imagined I'd be, wedged between the living and dead, singing spoiled prayers, wondering why I still want to reach across all the sorrow and make my father understand that forgiveness isn't absolution or mercy, but the grace that love makes, the only true wealth. And here we all are, children hurrying off to school, holding mother's hand, heads held high, shoulders straight, an enormous morning opening wide its pearly jade wings over everything, beginning again from the beginning.
Why did you make this the title of this volume?
Well, I struggled to find that title. I was going to call it The Artist and His Mother. I was going to call it Good News.
Actually, I meant, why did you make this poem the title poem of this collection?
Well, once I found the title, you know, first I found the title. I couldn't finish the poem. I just remembered that. I struggled with a poem. This poem was longer and going all over the place. I was trying to write, this is where I walked my dog and all these graves, and I would hear echoes, and I tried to make a poem about it, but I couldn't. And once I realized and I found the title, The Enormous Mourning, from a poem by Elizabeth Bishop. Whenever I'm in doubt, I turn to Bishop, my favorite poet. And I found that this phrase, this term, Enormous Mourning, was the title I wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, after Failure and God of Loneliness, I wanted something a little more uplifting. And once I had the title, I knew exactly which poem to go back to that I couldn't make work. And once I called it that, it all fell in place. Mm-hmm. And I had that poem. That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, once I had the title, I knew what the poem was about.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Philip Schultz about his latest volume of poetry, Enormous Mourning. So, positioned within the entire book, what to me I love so much is it begins, like so many of your poems, very much right in the here and now, in a place, in a specific place. And then the trajectory of your poems move from the particular to the personal to your own history and musings, and then to a larger tone, a larger sense of meaning. And this is something I've come to look for in your poems, and I think it's actually why I love them so much, that you start with, here we are, and there we go. And I wonder if you could say something about that process.
Yes. You know, there's a visual quality to my poetry because I began as a painter, wanted to be a painter, and first fell in love with painting. And my father taught me to draw cartoons, and I was the school cartoonist. And seeing things visually helped me when I started to write. And in the beginning, I wanted to be a novelist. I want a storyteller. So I had a narrative quality. Mm-hmm. Now, between the visual and the narrative, it's exactly what you're talking about. It's a scene. And I have a poem about the IGA, and it's the people in the IGA and standing in line, waiting to register the cash, to go to the cashier. And there's scenes, and when I come to that, usually the poem falls in place. And before, when I didn't have that title, I didn't have that. I was walking through the cemetery, but I didn't know what the poem was about yet.
And the title suggests renewal because you have mourning in there. M-O-R-N-I-N-G.
I know. When people, you know, the author of Failure, when people heard I was going to call it Enormous Mourning, they kidded me. They said, not M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. No, like good morning.
Mm-hmm. But it also has enormity, which implies weight. What does that tension between renewal and weightiness suggest for you?
Well, that's quite an interesting question. I'm thinking about that for the first time. I think whether I'm conscious of it or not, I'm always seeking some form of transcendence, probably in every poem I write. And that's hard to find. I mean, maybe it's why I write hundreds and hundreds of drafts, because I'm asking an awful lot of an idea. And once I can approach that, once I can find that, I feel transported emotionally, which is what I want. I mean, here I'm writing about being old and walking through a cemetery and feeling wedged between the living and the dead. Mm-hmm. That's not the most comfortable of feelings. And here's all these echoes. Well, what are my echoes? What will someone hear me be saying? Probably this poem.
Wonderful. And across the book, physical experience, if you just mentioned aging, illness, even touch, feels inseparable from the emotional and spiritual life. So I wonder if you could read this poem, Good News, and talk about, well, just read it and then comment on it. I think that would be best.
Good News. Embedded in my late-night community of insomniacs, here I am again, seeking diversion from wildfires, school shootings, and bombed hospitals, watching an old movie called Good News about a football hero falling in love with his French tutor. Made in 1947 after endless war, it's trying valiantly to point a way forward. Unlike me, these happy lovers aren't older than their imaginations, dealing with all sorts of stubborn melodies. Indeed, everyone here is young and swinging everyone else around a glittering dance floor, ecstatic about what lies ahead. Without doubt, the younger me would now be hopping over sofas, celebrating each precious moment of sanity. Yes, we're all relieved when bad news is happening elsewhere to someone else, at least for the time being. A week ago, wearing a cap and gown, my youngest son skied down a Vermont hill, happily embracing his future, while 2 weeks before, the wing of a plane his best friend's father was in broke off, and the future also drowned. Plato believed we live in a restless state of continual becoming and never being. Yes, the machinery of our endless striving after something that forever evades us, the closest we come to happiness, perhaps. In any case, here I am again, embedded in the wellsprings of mystery, seeking the smallest scrap of certainty, whatever remains buoyant and unbroken, racing toward the bottom of an expectant hill where the forever changing and irreversible future waits patiently for the time being.
Yeah, I so related to that because we are just surrounded with so much catastrophe, and the ability to find a place of joy is absolutely essential to us.
And a little certainty. You know, I do this. Sometimes I watch the news and it's overwhelming, and I find myself turning to CNN, TCM, and hoping that there's going to be something light, you know, or a musical or joyous. And this one time when I really needed it, there was this movie I had never heard of, and there were all these young people dancing ferociously, and it was so beautiful. It was so needed. I guess this is what we're all going through right now.
Yeah, it is. And when that happens to me, I think, what a contrast we are as human beings. I mean, you know, this. I'm appalled. I can't even imagine why the things that are happening are happening, why people take pleasure in other people's pain, why people have such a drive for the empty, you know, the emptiness of power over other things instead of power with and enjoyment of others. And yet, on the other hand, human beings are so capable of such transcendent beauty.
Well, I think this is a phenomena that I tried to deal with in the long poem, Something and Nothing, at the end of the book, where what is it about him, Trump, that's so captivated his audience, his followers? And what I came up with is that he gives people permission to be primitive, to express their hate, to those who feel left behind and put upon and not really acknowledged, which we all need. He found a way of giving them, as people in the Second World War did, permission to hate, to act out loud, say things out loud that they would only do in my neighborhood in corner bars. Mm-hmm. A lot of my friends' fathers would cause all kinds of trouble on a Saturday night, and that's where they could be themselves. He gives people permission to express hatred and misgivings, and he's this incredible con man that has worked for him. In the long poem, I call him Pinocchio, the liar of liars. And that's the function, I think, that's happened.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz about his terrific new volume of poetry, Enormous Morning. So you've mentioned this poem twice. It's probably too long for us to do the whole thing, but could you read a portion of it?
It's 25 pages. You want me to read a section of it?
Yeah, okay. Maybe read that section.
Okay. In the new backyard snow this morning, in the sycamores leaning ever closer, in the big walloping ocean wind and high morning sky unfolding ever so gently, in the smell of coffee downstairs, in the hands of my wife making it, the simmering deliverance, the unbridled light, we wearing masks after months of lockdown, saw it on my birthday, January 6, 2021, in our local museum sculpture garden, where from the hazardous assemblage of apes, parrots, Venuses, and that liar of liars, Mr. Pinocchio himself, all spread over a tractor's ruthless rake. The cavernous eyes of death's giant skull glared at us out of the savage paradox of art's insurrection in Jim Dine's The Wheatfield Agincourt. When suddenly our phones began wailing with an even more prolix assemblage, an even more savage kind of insurrection, which was now attacking our capital because Pinocchio himself told it to. Yes, now we too were staring out of death's cavernous eyes into the raging inferno. Jim Dine, Arshil Gorky, and Pinocchio himself personified.
That's so powerful, and to remind us of that day. Is there another section of the poem that you'd like to?
Yeah, I can just, section four. All truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, and this is a quote by Arthur Schopenhauer. All truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as self-evident. Now, aimless, ancient, and perplexed, my wife and I fearing being swallowed up by the barbarity of every wrong turn, dead end, and vulgar cul-de-sac fate had so brazenly assembled for us. Yes, we were fleeing, I believed, the furor and stagnation entrenched in the eyes of the boy and his mother in Gorky's painting, the symphony of who me, never again, and same to you, performed every Saturday night in corner bars in my old neighborhood by the woe-begone, for whom hate is the most cohesive union. Yes, the permission to be primitive out loud that Mr. Pinocchio himself was giving to his rollicking horde of primitives to attack the very thing they believed was being taken away from them. Yes, the question Pascal, that 17th century mathematical genius, asked, were we each an incomprehensible monster, Byzantine, willful, and unhappy enough to humble the exalted and exalt the humbled, to begin to accept as self-evident the very thing Pinocchio was attacking? In other words, were we worthy of so beautiful, prescient, and brittle an idea as democracy? And the Gorky painting that I'm referring to is The Artist and His Mother, which I thought of calling this. It's been, plays a role in the book, and it's a part of the sacrifice, I think, that I mentioned that. Gorky and his family were Armenian, and during the Armenian genocide, they used a march, a death march, as a kind of walking concentration camp. And they killed everyone, raped the women, and starved people. And Gorky's mother, in order to feed him and his two sisters, she starved to death in his arms. And this made him, when he came to America at the age of, I think, 19, he spent 10 years of his life doing this one painting based on a photograph of himself with his mother when he was 8 years old. And the painting so moved me when I first saw it that I wrote a poem about it. And the cover of my first book is a sketch for the painting. So this, again, is a lifelong obsession with this painting and sacrifice. His mother sacrificed her life to sustain him and his sisters. And war, ugliness, you know, look what they had to survive. He did and didn't, because he ended up hanging himself in his 40s, I believe.
So we've talked a number of times. Another poem was My Mistakes.
Okay.
Which I have a feeling is one of your favorites. Could you read that poem and tell us about it?
Let me find it. You know how we carry along guilt about things we did wrong? And I read, there was a book of essays by Schopenhauer that I found upstairs in the attic where I grew up. And an uncle had it, in one room was full of girly books, and the other room was full of first editions of Yeats and Pound. And here was this book by Arthur Schopenhauer, which I always carried around. And for some reason, only now, when I started writing these poems, did I really begin reading the book. Mm-hmm. And here's a quote from him. Human life must be some kind of mistake. yes, it's funny. Like his most famous book, I think, is called Studies of Pessimism.
A little like failure.
Right. I guess I would be drawn to that. My mistakes. My mistakes like to argue about which is the most offensive, their importance in our shared hierarchy of unforgivable deficiencies. Each, apparently, desires to be the most abhorrent and reviled. Simple ones, the things I shouldn't have said or done, words and names I mispronounce, friends I insulted without knowing why, get pushed aside by the more spirited ones. One especially enjoys reminding me what I said during a radio interview about a poet I thought I admired that was so envious and spiteful the radio host, looking for controversy, wouldn't let me change the subject. Sure, this one mistake whispers in the shower. It hurt many feelings, but I didn't have to accommodate him so keenly. One waits until I'm asleep to ask why. After all my father poems, in my one mother poem, after all her sacrifices, I mentioned her bunions and weak ankles, which hurt her so deeply. This one surely stands out, it likes to shout. Some are satisfied with simply stripping me of any lingering confidence, but others enjoy continuing ignobility. Yes, I try to ignore them, focus on more practical matters like bill paying and walking my dog Binks along the ocean. But even then, there they are, hobbling behind, sulking and bickering about which did the most harm, is the cruder and most intrusive. It's no use reminding them who provides a home. They know my passion for self-loathing is irresistible. One treasured mispronunciation at a time. It made me laugh. If you could laugh at your mistakes, I think that's a godsend.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you're able to laugh at them finally in a much yes. different way than you might have before. So maybe
that's that transcendence that I was talking about. That's a very good illustration. Yes, that's the point of writing poetry. I mean, that's what it gives you. You can look at your mistakes and even forgive them, which is what that first poem, Enormous Mourning, is about, forgiveness.
Poet Philip Schultz. Join us for more of our conversation after the break. This episode of Writer's Voice is sponsored by Larry's Coffee, coffee artists on a mission. Based in Raleigh, North Carolina, Larry's combines exceptional coffee with a deep commitment to doing good. Nearly all their beans are organic, fair trade, and shade grown, sourced through direct partnerships with farmers. Their eco-friendly roastery uses solar energy and rainwater systems, and they're a certified B Corporation, proving business can be a force for positive change. I've tried it. It's delicious. And every subscription through us supports Writer's Voice. Go to larryscoffee.com/voice. That's larryscoffee.com/voice. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to read our interview transcripts, check out Writer's Voice on Substack. We're celebrating Poetry Month today with one of my favorite poets, Philip Schultz. He's been one of our most loved guests on Writer's Voice, where we've talked with him about his previous books, the Pulitzer Prize-winning volume of poems Failure, and also The God of Loneliness, as well as his nonfiction memoir, My Dyslexia. You can listen to all of them at writersvoice.net. Let's get back to our conversation. Just before the break, we heard Philip Schultz reading his poem, My Mistakes. In that poem, Philip Schultz revisited moments of having hurt others. And yet in that, as with many of his poems with difficult feelings in them, there's still a kind of levity, of humor. I asked him if that came through the actual act of writing.
Yes, in a way, turning to poetry, to being creative, is a kind of turning to TCM and hoping I'm going to see something that's going to cheer me up. Because even if I'm dealing with a dark subject, the very act of creating, being creative, of using my mind in that way, my emotions in that way, my endurance in that way, is a kind of cheerfulness, is a kind of buoyancy that lifts me up. Even if I'm dealing with an impossible subject that maybe I felt had threatened me, my existence, dealing with it creatively is a form of excitement and satisfaction that, for me, only the writing of poetry creates.
And you also have many poems that are elegies, and I love them because they are very much about the person, but also about very much more. So I'd like you to read a couple of those. On the Edge of Things, on page 34.
Connie Fox was a great painter and a very, very dear friend out here, and this is an elegy for her. On the Edge of Things, in memory of Connie Fox. Yesterday, Monica and I said goodbye to a painter friend in hospice, a wonderful woman in her late 90s, who first came out here to the far eastern edge of Long Island in 1979 with her expressionist friend Elaine de Kooning, whose husband, Wilhelm, rode his bicycle past her house every morning, calling, "Good morning, Connie, best of luck." Where she met her husband, the sculptor Bill King, each obsessed with ripping the unspoken out of the known, the astonishing out of the everyday, the symphonic out of each trembling breath. Having suffered a stroke, she could now speak only in song, and with her daughter, Megan, we all held hands and sang, "I've Been Working on the Railroad," a song she sang to Megan as a girl. After kissing her goodbye, my wife and I walked along the ocean under the same red umbrella she opened in her paintings, and I wished I could have thanked her one last time for all those afternoons in her studio, revelation dancing from floor to skylight, color trembling inside whirling squares and sumptuous rectangles, her playing the fiddle and Bill the piano at our son's birthdays, her echoing laughter, yes, thanked her for introducing me to myself, the man hidden inside his own hours of light and ecstatic wings, thanked her for her gift of passion, for what lives on the edge of things. Yes, now paradise will be seen the way it was meant to, one edgy red umbrella at a time.
That's so wonderful. And how did she open you to yourself?
There was something about our conversations that was unlike any other conversations I had with anyone. She, I felt, kept me on the phone forever. I mean, I knew if she called, if I had a class or something I would have to do, I'd be in trouble. Because we would enjoy each other's company so profoundly that 2 hours would go by, and I didn't have 2 hours. And there was just something about her glee. It reminded me of her wonderful, now she was an abstract expressionist with all these forms, rectangles, umbrella. And one time she invited me over and I went over and I understood that it would be the whole afternoon. And I would go over there and she had this new painting she was working on with a big red umbrella in the middle of it. It was the only figurative form. And of course, no one was holding it. It was just floating in space. And she told me about it, and she showed me the actual umbrella. And she would discuss her work with me. And, you know, I began as a painter. I was the school cartoonist. I took art lessons right through graduate school. I loved I once, in a department store in Rochester, saw a book of paintings and saw the self a Van Gogh self-portrait. And I had to have it, and I actually put it under my shirt and tried to get out of the store, and they caught me. And I remember the store, the manager asked me, did I want them to call my father or the police? And I said, the police. And he came and he got me. And when we were driving home, he wasn't angry at all, which was, you know, he doodled. He taught me how to draw. Mm-hmm. He taught me how to draw cartoons. And he stopped at a traffic light and turned toward me and said, as if I were another person and not his son. He wanted to know what about that book that so fascinated me, because I had never done anything like that. Why had I tried to steal the book? And I told him there was something about this Van Gogh painting. It was the one with his cut ear. Mm-hmm. That there was such passion that I had to have it. And he smiled and took me home. And the next morning when I got up, the book was on the kitchen table.
Oh, that's lovely. So, in fact, the police were called, but your father did come.
Well, they called my father, not the police. I think I had a second thought about calling the police. The store manager just laughed when I said that. He thought it was so funny.
But that's a lovely story. And so we have met this man before in your books of poetry, and that's Santos. But you wrote one now after Santos died. It's on page 39. And so tell us briefly who Santos was and read the poem.
Santos was a guy, when I first got the house, I was broke. I bought it after a recession. It wasn't very much. It was a cottage in very bad shape. And I had my hands full. Friends came and they helped me put it together. I mean, one friend was an architect, and that's the only reason I could make it habitable. And here I was with this nice house, and I was exhausted. And one day I was in the front yard, realized picking up debris and trying to cut the grass, and I couldn't do it. And this guy appeared, this guy from Guatemala. He spoke English very sparingly, and he said, he was smiling. There was this look on his face. You know, in the front yard, I had this 9-year-old Ford station wagon that we called the Great White Whale, but was not the kind of car you usually see in the driveways here on this street. So he got the message. I didn't have money. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to make a home for myself. And And he came over and he said, let me help you. And I said, well, how much do you charge? He said, don't worry about it. We'll work it out. Mm-hmm. And he finished cutting the grass. And, you know, I paid him a couple of dollars. And he came. He was living in his wife's adopted mother's house across the street, which was a wreck of a house also. It wasn't her house. It wasn't their house. His wife's mother took care of a white woman, a very rich woman, who bought that house and let her stay in it for her to take care of her. Mm-hmm. And Santos wasn't there for very long. They had to find their own place. But I had a wreck on my hands. It wasn't really, you know, habitable. I mean, my friends had helped me a lot. But suddenly, there were things that were pointed out in the inspection that needed to be corrected in order to be legal. And I showed him that. And I was amazed that he knew how to do this rather sophisticated architectural stuff. His wife later explained to me that he was all but an architect in Guatemala, that he had actually studied and knew all this stuff. Like, he could look at a blueprint that other handymen would look at and not be able to understand, decipher. He knew exactly how to do that. And he enjoyed working for me. He identified with me in some way, and we were equals. I had a little more money. And I remember coming in and seeing all the poetry. And when I explained to him that I was a poet, he laughed and enjoyed it so much that I got the message. It was something we both laughed at, like, you do this for a living? And, well, over the years, we became fast friends. I'd invite him to things, and it was very sad how he died of COVID. He needed a liver transplant, which he didn't believe in doctors, and he wouldn't go, and I all but forced him to sometimes see doctors. And his wife, Rosie, died of a heart attack. She worked in the deli department. They so loved her, they put a bench outside the building. She worked there for 30 years when it was called the AMP. And anyway, I really loved him. Anyway, I'll read the poem. Santos, in memory of Jose Santos Cox Chale. One Saturday in 1991, after a hurricane, there you were, helping me clean up the wreck of a cottage I had just bought after a recession. You lived across the street in your wife's adopted mother's house, owned by a rich younger white woman she cared for, an absurdity that somehow made perfect sense. Suddenly, a new roof, fenced-in yard for my dog, a studio for my sculptor wife, and a deck to dream my poems on. Yes, we both agreed. A grown man writing poems for a living. A hilarious idea. You dreamed of being an architect, your wife Rosie said. But in Guatemala, one earned calluses, not degrees. My country, you'd say with sorrow, as if Guatemala was a place you had abandoned and betrayed. The me you liked wasn't privileged, educated, and assimilated, but someone who honored memory, a property you also owned. For hours, we'd watch Penelope catch frisbees, entranced by the idea of passion being rewarded by pride. Often, you knew before I did that something needed to be fixed, replaced, or pardoned. As if the world of order you esteemed didn't tolerate the insolence of neglect. After Rosie died of a heart attack as you drove her to work at Stop and Shop, you came by one last time, asking for work. Crippled by liver disease, too broken to stand, the money I gave you broke both our hearts. You once asked why I insisted on going with you to see a man who refused to pay you. I didn't really understand why, but I do now. I wanted to see what your opposite looked like, someone so lacking in wonder, humor, and elegance.
What a beautiful tribute. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz about his terrific new volume of poetry, Enormous Morning. And finally, you bring together the personal and the political, and there were two poems here that I found particularly inspiring and poems that I needed to read. And they are Navalny, about Alexei Navalny, and the other poem is Democracy. And so as we go out, we are talking now just a few days before the third No Kings Day that is going to go on. You know, we are facing a democracy that is very weakened, and yet when I read poems like Democracy and Navalny, I have hope again.
Well, I followed his story, and I found it almost beyond remarkable. Mm-hmm. How, when the fact that he was safe here and went back knowing what would happen. You know, I think of St. Joan. Where does that kind of courage come from? It's almost unbelievable. He had a sense of what's right and what's good, and he couldn't live with what's bad. He couldn't live not fighting and resisting, you know, fascism, authoritarianism. Navalny. Sacrifice is an expensive word, an even more expensive idea. Imagine the cost of giving up everything for one's belief, loving your ideals more than yourself, surviving every kind of abuse day after day, the expense of such passion, such faith. Where does such strength of will, belief in the idea of goodness, come from? Did Alexei A. Navalny wish to mentor the world, set an example history couldn't repudiate? Imagine the pride and satisfaction, the cunning, the delight and torment in destroying before the eyes of the world the conscience of his tormentors. Now it's our turn. Now we must summon the courage to at least ask what we would sacrifice, whether we deserve, can afford our freedom.
Yes, a question I ask every day. You know, when I think of what he did, of what Alexei Navalny did, I can't imagine doing the same. And yet I think that it happens in the moment. You just are confronted with something that you can't abide. You can't do any other thing than the right thing.
Well, we don't know until we're in that position, but writing this poem forced me into a corner where I had to ask that, and I wouldn't have asked otherwise. How can you answer that? I mean, you know it's certain death, and not only death, but they tortured him. And imagine, I mean, this horrible human being, Putin, who's, in a sense, the mentor of our president, who looks up to him, wants to walk in his footsteps. This is what we're up against.
And so to democracy.
Okay. Democracy. A charming form of government. It's a quote from Plato. A charming form of government, full of variety and disorder, dispensing a sort of equality to equals and unequals alike. Plato. On this cold November evening, democracy and I are walking along the ocean, arguing about why everyone in my old neighborhood hated where everyone else came from, behaved as if hate was our faith, Envy and prejudice are nature. Sometimes, after arguing, democracy and I reminisce about a past we both believe loved us more than it does now. But not tonight. Tonight, feeling vulnerable, it admits, it can be clumsy, even suspicious, occasionally cruel and overbearing. But remember, it hums, George Washington and Abe Lincoln thought I was worth dying for. Plato believed my soul is immortal and therefore indestructible. Yes, I cry, but he also saw you as the tyranny of the ignorant majority, a collision of the just and the jaundice, the frenzy of the marketplace, preferred an aristocracy of philosopher kings. Still, we agree, a splendid idea about passion, reason, and change, protecting oneself against one's ignorance and greed, the technicolor kingdom our dreams live in. Yes, democracy and I lament, here we are again at war with the delirious and self-obsessed, teetering on a precipice, singing a song half-swallowed and off-key about our hunger for satisfaction, the intrinsic goodness that feeds our inmost being. Yes, here we are, riddles wrapped in a theory, hidden in a paradox about the mind's hunger for something as redolent and willfully unremitting as dignity, as hopeful and curiously radical as happiness, and yes, as tormented and ever fleeting, as magnificently surprising and pleasing in its reach as, yes, say it, freedom.
Philip Schultz, thank you so much for reading that and for talking with us here. Just one last question, and maybe it sounds a little hokey, but I think you're going to have a really good answer to it, and that is, in times like this, when we need to call up our courage and our dignity, our will to freedom, how does poetry help us do that?
Well, poetry is always a struggle by poets to understand something. And when you read it, you are also struggling to understand, to come to terms with something, to look at something that you maybe prefer not to. And that kind of confrontation takes strength and courage. It's exactly the strength and courage we need to deal with what's going on now in our lives.
Poet Philip Schultz. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again or check out our previous conversations with him. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.